I think I doubled my followers on LinkedIn specifically from 2024 to 2025 or something like that.
And then in 2025, you made around $200,000 as a creator. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
You said that creators should over-deliver on brand deals.
100%. I'm easy to work with. I make sure I meet deadlines. I over-communicate and I over-deliver on content. If they ask for 3 stories, literally we'll give them like 10 stories.
Is there any LinkedIn posting advice you see out there that you would say is just nonsense or just ignore it?
Posting every day is pretty nonsense. I actually think that's hurting folks rather than helping.
CreatorBuzz made $2.5 million in 2025, right?
I think in September of 2025, we hit $1 million. And then by end of year, we actually crossed like $2.5 million. So we like more than doubled our revenue within like 4 month period.
Where did the increase come from?
One of the big pieces that I changed was...
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Vin Metano, who is a creator himself. He specializes in B2B on LinkedIn in particular. He made $200,000 as a creator last year. He's also the owner of a B2B influencer marketing agency called CreatorBuzz that made $2.5 million last year. So this conversation starts talking about his own experience as a creator, goes into his experience running CreatorBuzz, and then we end giving his perspective on LinkedIn and how to succeed on the platform. Enjoy. In 2024, I understand you made around $94,000 as a creator yourself. And then in 2025, you made around $200,000 as a creator. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Where did the increase come from? Was it just like you going out and looking for more deals? Was it that you were able to increase your prices? Where did that more than doubling come from?
Well, I think it was just like growth of my channels, really, at the end of the day. And then it was also figuring out a style that worked with brands. I think made it a little bit more attractive for the brands to then want to work with me. I think also at 2024, I also was still like full-time employed and I was in my sales role. Yeah. And I was only making sales content. So my brand partnerships were only so limited to companies within the sales technology space. And while there are a lot of those companies, you know, you can only go so far. Whereas once I quit and started my own business, I started opening up my content to a different types of audiences, started doing founder-led content, more storytelling stuff. And that opened it up to more brand partnerships. And at the same time, my channel also grew. I think I doubled my followers on LinkedIn specifically from 2024 mm-hmm. to 2025 or something like that. There's some big growth on the channel.
I know that right now on LinkedIn, you are right around 50,000, and that's your largest platform, though all the others are not far behind. I think TikTok is somewhere around 40, and Instagram is also almost 50. And then you're on Twitter, but it's pretty minor. It's really those three platforms for you, right?
Correct. Yeah. And my goal this year is to try to grow the YouTube channel, but that's like
7,000 right now, right?
Yeah. It's all through shorts. So I don't really get too many views on YouTube.
Yeah. YouTube's a hard one.
It's tough.
So that 200K, is that entirely from brand partnerships, or do you have other ways you're bringing in money as a creator yourself?
It's actually mostly through brand partnerships. I don't do any like really affiliate stuff, to be honest with you. So it's mostly through brand partnerships and UGC content. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider myself a UGC creator, but however, sometimes brands will that I'm working with in a partnership capacity, they'll say like, "Hey, we will want some additional videos." Yeah, sometimes I'll go to events and sell street interviews, which mm-hmm. I think is like the biggest hack for creators. Like, especially if you go to a lot of conferences or events, like just reaching out to people or brands that are sponsoring those events and offering some street interviews and just like selling them the street interviews. I did that in Cannes. I saw who was sponsoring Cannes Lions. I reached out to a few companies, one company in particular, while I was already there. So it was like money on top of money. I did 5 street interviews and sent it to them, and then they owned them and, you know, posted them and did whatever they needed with it.
Can you share which brand that is?
Yeah, it was with Meltwater. So we asked us like some fun, like social questions, and I was already going to Cannes. So it was just like icing on the cake. So for any like creator listening, I think that's a really easy way to like just kind of maximize your time at conferences and actually like earn a little bit on the side while you're there.
Mm-hmm. How many brands do you think you worked with total last year in 2025?
Not many, actually. Not many. A lot of the money came from maybe like 3 partners, and it was mostly LinkedIn. Actually, maybe mostly 2, LinkedIn and Adobe. Mm-hmm. And then the rest came from just like one-off stuff that had come up that I thought was like a good fit or anything like that.
So just a couple of brands. How about deliverables? I'm sure this number is a little amorphous and I doubt you have like the specific number, but if you had to guess, like how many videos, how many posts, how many total deliverables went into that 200K number?
I would say I try to do no more than like 4 a month, which is 1 a week. Mm. And I don't even think I've ever really passed that unless like it just so happened. Like for Cannes Lions, there was a lot of content going out because the brands that was there with wanted a lot of deliverables. So that was probably like the only like one-off scenario where I was like posting a lot of sponsored posts in a short amount of time. But yeah, roughly around like 4 a month potentially.
That's not bad. So on another podcast appearance, you said that creators should over deliver on brand deals, and specifically 100%. That this is a way to develop relationships and land these long-term deals, which it sounds like you had with, or maybe still have with LinkedIn and Adobe. To quote exactly what you said here, you said, if you can get in with just one piece of content, just do it and over deliver. If they ask for one video, give them 2 videos. If they ask mm-hmm. for one story, give them 12 stories. But what you just said, it sounds like that's like a tactic only specifically to quickly build a relationship to then open up these long-term deals. It's not like always over deliver. Can you speak on that a little more?
I mean, I still always like to over deliver personally. Even when I, like, for example, now running this agency, I understand that sometimes there are agencies that manage many budgets for many different brands that you might want to work with. And so if you can show that you're easy to work with to an agency, for example, that holds the budget to a lot of different brands, they're going to be really quick to recommend you across all of their brands. So like there's one agency in particular that I work with like 3 of their brands. And they know because I'm easy to work with. I make sure I meet deadlines. I over communicate and I over deliver on content. Like prior, you asked earlier, like what was that jump from 94K to 200K from 2024 to 2025? One of the big pieces that I changed was previously I didn't use a videographer, but whenever I got a brand deal in 2025, I would outsource a videographer to enhance the quality of the ad that I was creating. Also the editing, like I can only edit so much, and I want, you know, working with an expert actually enhances the quality. And then over deliver, like if they wanted extra hooks, like, oh, we maybe want to try a different hook out. Sometimes they ask you for that. Like just give them extra hooks. Sometimes just like record it proactively. Like, hey, I recorded two different videos, just has 2 different hooks, 2 different CTAs. Like, let me know which one you like better. If they ask for stories, I always like, story is the easiest thing. Like I like over deliver. If they ask for 3 stories, I literally will give them like 10 stories. I don't care. I'll just like dump on my story.
Okay. Another thing, purely because you are a salesperson and I know you know, in your previous job, you were quite a good salesperson looking at your LinkedIn. I would guess that the majority of your personal brand partnerships have come from outbound. Is that guess correct?
No, actually. Oh. Yeah, a lot of pretty much all. See, I'm not a full time creator, so I'm not as reliant on this income. So mm-hmm. I don't spend a lot of time trying to source brand partnerships. Now, when I go to events, yeah, maybe I might reach out to a brand that I see is there just to like again maximize my earnings while I'm at these events. But for the most part, I would say like 80% of my brand partnerships from last year probably came from inbound. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's important to be able to close on the call though. Like early on when I was first getting started, I would try to meet with as many of these brands as possible. So if they reached out to me to like inquire about a brand partnership, I would always try to hop on a call with them. Sometimes the brands are like unwilling to do that. If they're reaching out to so many creators, they're not as willing to jump on a call with every single creator. So it's worth shooting your shot. And if they do take you up on it, I highly recommend hopping on a call with them. And that allows you to just like put a face to the name. It shows that you're really like serious about it. And I feel like early on in my journey when I didn't have as many followers, that did allow me to secure more brand partnerships just by doing that.
Yeah. So tell me more about like winning these negotiations. Sounds like step one is when you are receiving the inbound call, make sure to get on the call. How do you like in those conversations, what are you doing? What are you asking of them? And what are you giving of yourself to make sure that you get the best possible outcome from that deal?
Yeah, well, it's really important to understand like why they reached out to you in the first place. So usually, I mean, I would hope there's targeted outreach on behalf of the brand or the agency that's reaching out to you. And so you want to understand why they reached out to you. What campaign are they currently supporting? What are the goals of the campaign? Sometimes they might say, hey, you know what? You have a big audience of salespeople and we have this product and we really want to get it in front of the eyes of salespeople. Cool. Okay. Then you can figure out how to integrate that into your content that you're already making. So that's like the main goal. And then you could also ask them like, what would mean like a successful partnership for us? Like you can show your intention that you do want to have a long-term relationship. I think creators make the mistake at least that I've seen just by doing a lot of creator outreach for our agency, creators always push back on one-off agreements. They're always like, oh yeah, I'm looking for something more long-term. And as you should, however, you can't expect something long-term if you've never worked with the brand before. So my two cents is always like over-deliver, get your foot in the door with that brand, whether it's one post, a story, anything, like however you can get your foot in the door with that brand and then over-deliver, that's how you're going to secure the long-term brand partnerships, which is exactly how my relationship with Adobe had started. I did some UGC work for them, maybe in 2023. And like, I don't know, it wasn't much. It was like one small project. And I like gave them these three videos. And the use case I wasn't even like super excited about. But I just did it anyway, just to like start working with Adobe. And then like 2.5 years later, still working with them. And it's last year, it was definitely my biggest partner from a brand partnership perspective.
Nice. So, I mean, you're saying make sure that like the reason they reach out to you is clear, make sure that they're giving you the goals. How often are you having to sort of manage up like this versus how often are brands coming to you with like a really well-crafted brief? Like how much of that brief finalization do you usually have to do?
Yeah, I think most times, especially with the brands I'm working with now, I think they come like very prepared in terms of the brief.
Adobe, LinkedIn.
Yeah, of course. I think like, I think that advice is more so for like creators that are trying to like scale or get started or starting to work with some more maybe legitimate brands. If you're getting started in your journey, you might not have as much leverage, right? And so getting on a call with a brand is definitely going to like help you create that relationship more. At the end of the day, it's all relationship building. Like the brands or agencies are not going to recommend a creator that they don't actually like. If they're hard to work with, if they're rude, if they like under deliver, if they do the bare minimum, if they ask for a video and all of a sudden you just send over like a selfie talking head video with like no edits, no B-roll, no captions, like the brand's never going to suggest you again, no matter how many views you get.
Yeah. I'm thinking like if there are patterns between different types of brands that change how the partnership might go, specifically like working with a really large company like Adobe, LinkedIn, really established company versus an early stage startup. Is that a pattern that will differentiate how a partnership will go or not?
Yes. I mean, super generally speaking.
Yeah.
Most times the startup is less prepared for this because they maybe haven't just done it as much or they don't have as much bandwidth to like create a proper brief or, you know, do the proper reviews and approvals to get content live. And there's also less red tape you have to go through from a startup perspective. Some, you know, I've seen startups not even review content and just be like, hey, just mention us and throw on the brand partnership toggle and we're cool with it. And I've been part of that early on. Once you work with the larger companies like the LinkedIn, the Adobe's, the Microsofts of the world, you know, there are some pros and cons to it. Pros is that you have this really reputable brand, you're working with really cool products that you actually like love and use. But the other challenge to working with a big brand like that is, you know, they want specific messaging. They have legal involved in all of these conversations. So you have to be very, very careful. If I was recording a video with Adobe or LinkedIn or Microsoft or a big company like that, I wouldn't be able to wear this outfit. Like this is a brand logo. You have to monitor everything. I literally have taped to my laptop permanently because you're not allowed to show any other logos in your content. They're very specific on the shots they want. They're very specific on the product UI that you're showing. So it takes way longer to get a piece of content live with a bigger brand than a small startup.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. On another podcast, you said that your very first brand deal was around $200 and your first major brand deal was around $9,000, which was for three videos and was around 3 years into your creator work. How large, I don't know if this is the right question for this. Tell me if it's not, but how large was your audience at that first point, that $200 deal? And then that first major deal, the $9,000 for three videos.
Well, that data may be a little outdated as well. The largest deal that I had was around 28K for a brand deal. It consisted of multiple videos. How was it like? It was like three videos, one LinkedIn post and like a bunch of stories, I believe.
Yeah.
And it was somewhere around 28K. And that at that point I had a similar following. It was quite recent. So it was probably
a similar following to the 9K deal.
To right now, I'm saying.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The 9K deal was like my biggest deal at the time.
Yeah.
And at that time, I probably had maybe like 30K on LinkedIn. the 200K, the $200
That's a couple
deal.
Years.
Yeah, that'll be a couple of years. The $200 deal, though, that was when I had like maybe 10 or 15K on LinkedIn, and it was for like a sales technology company, and I just had to like write a text LinkedIn post. It was very, very easy. And I was like, oh, this is sick. I could just do this, you know, once a month, and this is like requires not that much work. And I don't know. I thought I made it.
What was the genesis of you starting to create content, by the way? Was it a sort of thing where I'm doing sales and I want to show up more often on people's feeds, so I'm going to make content to do that?
I first started making I've been making LinkedIn content for like over 6 years now, and I started making LinkedIn content because I graduated college and I didn't have a job. Mm. And I was trying to find a job. And so I realized every time I posted on LinkedIn, you know, recruiters would reach out to me and, you know, interviews might come from it. So I was trying to be like really active on LinkedIn before to find a job, really. And then once I got a job, I just started sharing some sales stuff. I was doing like interesting prospecting strategies that like my team at Demandbase found interesting. So I would like share those on LinkedIn and they would get like minimal performance. And then I had one post go crazy viral at the time. And I still deem this as a viral post on LinkedIn. This was in 2019 and I had a post break 1 million views and like over 1,000 likes. And on LinkedIn, especially in 2019, that is like mega viral on the platform.
Definitely.
I know it's not as like viral on other platforms, but on LinkedIn, it's big time. And it was a prospecting story about how we closed a deal and it led me to meeting Gary Vaynerchuk. So it's like a whole story around it. And that was the first time it went viral and I got a lot of followers from it. And I was like, oh, I could continue sharing some sales practices. Like people, I guess people like this stuff. And so that's where it started. And then I started like investing into other platforms like TikTok and Instagram. I've always made videos, but never like posted it or made it about my job. So then I kind of did more like career focused type of content. And that was probably around like 2020, 2021.
Nice. In 2023, you posted this breakdown of your then part-time creator income, and it was 45% brand partnerships, 19% advising, 12% coaching, 11% digital products, 7% UGC, and 6% affiliate, which I bring this up just to say you've tried a good mix of these classic creator revenue streams. Which are the worst? Oh, good.
And that year, I only made $34,000, and I was doing all those things.
Yeah, so those percentages are like of 34K. Which are those things, whether it's UGC, affiliate, digital products, coaching, whatever, which of these things did you have the worst experience with that you would like, you never really want to do again, or that you would advise other people against pursuing?
Oh, I don't advise. I definitely don't advise against anything. Everyone has their own like way of doing it. Like some creators are really great at selling courses, which I created a sales course for like cold email writing, because that's what my content was about at the time. I just didn't like it personally. I didn't like promoting it. I just hated everything about it personally. And so I think I made maybe like 10, I don't even remember, a few grand from it without ever promoting it. Cause I just gave me like the ick a little bit.
You didn't feel comfortable selling. There's like that image I've seen online. It's like at a restaurant is it hot? Are you proud to serve it? It's like from a restaurant.
Yeah. The content was good. I just, for some reason, I just didn't like, I didn't want to sell to my audience personally, but I actually am a consumer of courses. I bought many courses, so I see the value in them. So there's absolutely no hate on that. I just, for me personally, I didn't like it. And then I feel like in order to keep that afloat, you have to always like make new courses and continue promoting the courses. I just didn't feel like doing that. I mean, by far the most fruitful is brand partnerships, in my opinion.
Yeah, still.
And I know people still, I don't know, there's a lot of narrative online about like, oh, it's so like inconsistent or unreliable. And I don't know, as a part-time creator, I think there's no better way to spend your time. In terms of like time in and versus money out, it's the highest percentage.
Yeah. One of my goals this year is to hit 10,000 followers on LinkedIn. It is honestly one of the most underrated social platforms. Helps me land podcast interviews, connect with smart people in the creator economy, and reach an audience that engages with what I'm doing. I'm currently at 4,967 followers. So the only way I'm going to get to 10,000 is by showing up consistently with useful content. To help with that, I have been using Taplio. Taplio is an all-in-one LinkedIn growth tool that helps creators like us build a real posting routine. I can generate first drafts from ideas, create image carousels without needing design tools, find relevant posts to engage with, and actually understand what my analytics are telling me. And as today's sponsor, Taplio is offering listeners a 7-day free trial plus your first month for just $1. Just head to taplio.com, that's taplio.com, and use code CREATOR1X1 to grab the offer and start building your own LinkedIn growth routine with Taplio today. So, part-time creator, you're a full-time agency owner. Let's talk about Creator Buzz. You left your job about a year and a half ago. Summer 2024 is when you started Creator Buzz, correct?
Correct. June 2024. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so Creator Buzz is a B2B influencer marketing agency. You don't have like a roster of creators. This is not a talent agency. Brands come to you to set up B2B influencer marketing campaigns, and you set it all up, correct?
Spot on.
Yeah. So walk me through a typical engagement. We could use my former employer, one of your clients, Air, as an example. For the listener, I should clarify that you started working with Air after I left Air. But walk me through like a typical, a specific campaign sure, you've done with Air from like them coming to you through sourcing creators all the way to wrapping up the campaign.
Yeah. Well, I'll say Air specifically, they make it really easy because they're always coming up with campaigns and like creative ideas. So we're basically for them just helping with the creator distribution, the creator support. Mm-hmm. Like, so for example, traditional B2B is at the end of the year, a lot of folks, they do like reports, or data reports, trend reports. So Air is producing this one report at the end of 2025. And it was a trend report for 2026. What's going to happen? What are the predictions in marketing next year that are going to happen? Traditional white paper. This is a traditional B2B marketing strategy. White papers, very popular to do, not the most sexy thing to promote. And so they worked with some industry experts and some creators to actually contribute to this report. So we had the creators actually contribute to the report and share their prediction. And then we helped source some of the creators to actually share that prediction in a Instagram reel. And then the CTA was to go download the report. And so for that example, we had like five creators share their own prediction that's going to happen. And then the CTA was to go download the report on the Air website. And then we used like a mini chat automation to lead to downloads. And I think we generated around like 6,200 downloads or something for the report, which is pretty crazy.
So I'm thinking of like some of the names I remember that were in that report. There's Eugene Healy. There's, I think, Taylor Lorenz did one. I think Oren John, which I know some of these people are people that Air has worked with before, that Ari, my former boss there, who you work with, has relationships with. So what were you doing? Like, what new relationships were you bringing in? Were you helping find like other creators too who weren't in the report, but who could benefit from like making content about the report to promote it?
We were, exactly. So they already have like existing relationships with creators, as most brands do. So in this particular scenario, we were helping find new faces and new voices who also can contribute to the report and then showcase and talk through their prediction on Instagram. So the five creators that we sourced for that campaign, which was quite small, those were all like new faces to like the Air ecosystem, I guess, if you will.
Yeah. How do you go about sourcing?
We have folks dedicated on our team to like constantly finding new creators. We also have a database and like a forum on the website that people can like sign up. So we have like a small network of creators, and then we're constantly just like looking for folks, no matter like when we sign a new client, like that's part of the game, is like they might have recommendations, we might have recommendations, and then we do some like recruiting and outsourcing for new faces. And I think the human element of like trying to go out and find creators is pretty important too, because there's like sort of like a taste element as well to it. And then in B2B, I think the particular niches are also extremely important. Like, in the consumer space, if I wanted to like sell this Owala water bottle, it doesn't really matter what kind of content you make. Like, I can integrate this water bottle into anything, like a fitness creator, a lifestyle creator, a mom creator. Like, anyone can integrate this water bottle. Anyone can buy that water bottle. But in B2B, it's like ultra specific. Like, we don't even want to just work with marketers. Like, even marketers is too niche. Not niche enough, I should say. Yeah. Too broad, right? We want to work with like someone in marketing operations, or in Air's case, like creative directors. So that's like the other element of sourcing creators as well.
Yeah. So earlier you were telling me like how you as a creator manage these conversations. How do you, on the creator acquisition side, more on the brand side, how do you manage these conversations from that side?
Yeah, I always say to our team, like, we should be the ones that always had the last reply in the thread. In some cases, you know, we do have to, we're kind of like playing in the middle, right? We're talking to the creator, but then we're also talking to the brand. And sometimes there's some time that's, there's like a waiting period, right? We maybe need to get an approval from the brand, and the creator is kind of just waiting for that. Any creator can kind of relate to this. They know, like, once they submit content for approval, sometimes it takes days. And if you're working at a really big company, sometimes it may take over a week just to get like a word back on a review. And so it's really important to like keep that creator in the loop of what's going on. And I know as a creator myself, like I hate when I submit a content for approval and it's like a week goes by and like I don't hear from the brand. Not weeks, weeks is crazy, but like a week goes by and like I don't hear from the brand. I get upset. I'm like, I worked on this. I'm like, I'm really proud of it. And so from that experience, I try not to do that with our creators and try to like keep them in the loop. Like, hey, thanks, we love it. X, Y, and Z. These are the specific things we liked about it. We're going to send this to review. If we didn't hear back from the brand in a few days, of course, we're following up with them, but we can reply back to the creator and just being like, hey, just letting you know, like it's still in review. We should expect something by Friday, whatever.
Yeah. How many people is Creator Buzz today and what are their roles?
Well, we have 7 full-time employees. And then we were also like just working with some contractors as well. The roles right now are pretty much all client facing. So we have, of course, myself, we have 2 like account managers, if you will, that's more like client facing, like specifically focused on brand relationships. And then we have 3 like creator focused folks that focus on the creator relationship. So they're the ones doing the creator outreach and creator comms. And then we have 1 person that's handling APs. So paying all the creators. I think we paid over like 226 creators last year.
Wow. Across, are you able to share like across how many deals that was or how many brands rather?
Yeah, we paid, so the number is we paid 212 creators over 26 countries last year. And it was probably over, definitely somewhere over 20 brands, I would say.
Wow.
Yeah.
You told me when we first spoke, if you're comfortable sharing this number out here, that that Creator Buzz made $2.5 million in 2025, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
Yeah. How, like, what was the momentum here? Because, you know, you entering 2025, the company is like about 6 months old. Was that mostly like in the back end, or were you able to really hit the ground running and it was like, you know, the full year was just packed?
No, it actually all happened in like the last quarter of the year, actually, which is pretty crazy. You know, I started in 2024 and it was at the end of, it was like the summer of 2024. So we really only had like 5 months worth of business in 2024. Yeah. So yeah, that was like also figuring it out. And then 2025 was the first like full year where we're like, okay, let's like lock in sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the goals is like, oh, I want to hit $1 million in revenue. That would be a really great goal to have for like the first year. And it was looking like we were going to hit it, or like we were like very, very close. And then I think in September of 2025, we hit $1 million. And then by end of year, we actually crossed like 2.5 million. So we'd like more than doubled our revenue within like 4 month period, which was pretty crazy. And so we just had like some crazy growth. And then it bled over into 2026, like the first few months of 2026, we're seeing similar growth. I think we'll kind of like blow our number out again this year, hopefully, if all goes
knock on wood. Amazing. What when you ended, Tom, producer Tom, leave that knock on wood in the audio.
Yes,
when you ended 2024, how many people were in the business, or was it still just you and you hired everybody in 2025?
In 2024, we had 3 or 4 people. And then we added 3 more in October of 2025.
Yeah. Did you manage people at your last job at Demand Base, or is this like totally new for you?
No, Demand Base, like I was completely new business in my former role. So I was doing prospecting, I was doing cold email, cold calling, I was closing deals, was doing sales cycles, selling like large enterprise deals. But once I closed that deal, it passed on to a customer team. Mm. So I never, ever, ever managed a customer in my life. And I was a solo, like I was a, they call it a sole contributor.
Yeah.
Meaning you're just like just a salesperson basically. So I never had to manage anyone. I did have some experience in the sales universe. There is an AE, which is what I was, and you're paired with an SDR, which is more of an entry-level salesperson that helps you do prospecting. So in that capacity, there was some like management to it, but I was not that person's direct manager. So yeah, this is all new muscles to me. Like I never managed customers before. I never managed a team before. And frankly, those are the two areas where like I'm not as great at, and like I that's yeah. like the, requires like the it's the highest learning curve for me that I'm experiencing so far running the business.
Speak more about that, like this transition from, you know, solo employee and part-time creator to now like agency operator.
Yeah, it's just there. You know what? I still struggle with this, but like I really struggled with this in the beginning. Again, never managing customers before.
Yeah.
I would work with a client, like we would sign a client. I'm working on a client campaign with Creator Buzz now. And I would be like working my ass off on this campaign. However, I made the mistake of like, I was not updating the client on what I was working on because I just didn't know you had to do that. And so I would get so much feedback from clients being like, hey, we haven't heard from you all week. Like, what are you doing? What exactly are you doing? And I would like kind of get offended. My first reaction was like kind of to be offended because I was like, yo, I am working my ass off on this. But I really just made the mistake of not updating them, of being like, hey, by the way, team, this is what I'm working on right now. Here's the update of what I'm working on. That was something I need to learn. And I'm still not great at it. I'll be the first to say it. My team is way better at it.
That's why I hire people.
Yeah, they do really great recaps for the clients. I am not great at it. But that was something I had to learn very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then the other part is like managing a team. I didn't realize, especially as the founder and how small we are, pretty much every question goes up to me. And I didn't realize how much of like how involved I would need to be in like the day-to-day stuff. And we're still early on. So like I hope like as we grow, I can get less involved in the more day-to-day stuff that's going on. Like we haven't reached that point of growth yet. I'm still very much involved in everything. So that was just a little bit of a surprise to learn that. Mm-hmm.
Is most of your business, most of Creator Buzz's business coming through your content, specifically your LinkedIn posts?
Yes. And referrals. Yeah, usually when I get on a call, luckily we really haven't gone outbound yet at all. I think very small percentage of our revenue is outbound. And so most of the stuff is inbound, and I usually try to ask them like how they heard of us. And it's usually like they either saw some of my LinkedIn posts or they just say, oh, I spoke with this person and they recommended you guys. So that's typically how it's coming in right now.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about transparency building in public. Obviously, you're quite comfortable sharing some of these numbers. You've given me the 200K number, the 2.5 million number. And I was wondering about like the border for you. And I'll say, you know, before we started recording, you said you were expecting a call from a potential new client. And I asked if you would share off record. You declined to share. And I respect that.
That's a sales paranoia tactic. Any salesperson, like they won't speak on what it is until the deal is closed.
Don't count your chickens before they hatch.
That's some like, what do you call it?
Superstition. Yeah. I'm thinking of, there's like a, I don't know if you watch soccer, but there's this player, Jack Grealish. And I saw this thing where like he was in the second league of English football and he had these, you know, the boots is what they call cleats. And they were like totally ripped up. His toes were sticking out and he like wore them for a championship game because he'd like won something in them before.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's an aside. But so that makes total sense. But the question is like, you are very comfortable sharing a lot of details. And so I get that this one is like, literally just don't count the chickens before they hatch.
Yep.
But what's your boundary on like what you do and don't want to be transparent about your business and about these numbers or anything about it?
When I first started the business, I was doing these like financial breakdowns every single month. And then I moved to like every quarter just because it like became a lot. I haven't done it in a long time. I remember I was talking to someone that was like a little bit older and more experienced. And they're like, oh, you're going to get to a point where you're not going to want to share the finances. And I was like, man, F this guy.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't mind sharing the total number. In my financial breakdown videos, though, I was like going through all the numbers and the revenue and like the percentages. And I just kind of felt, I kind of stopped wanting to do it because I was like, I don't know how the clients would feel. I don't want them to feel like I'm showing this because I'm like trying to brag like, oh, we're making an X amount. It was more so about like, I never ran a business before. And whenever you hear like this company did $1 million in revenue, you're like, well, what does that mean? Like, how much of that do you keep? How much of that is like, where are the expenses to run $1 million business? And so that was the goal behind running through the numbers. I've thought about bringing it back to some extent, maybe doing like quarterly or like an annual breakdown. Totally not out of the question. I try to be as open as possible. I think in the business that I'm in the creator economy, it would be so silly not to like really lean into the whole like founder, creator led business.
Yeah.
I see it happening so much in the consumer space with like you know, let's like Prime, Logan Paul on Prime, like Joyride and Ryan Trahan, like those are businesses that exist, but they are very creator led focused. And so I really wanted to lean into that when starting the business.
Two other examples, perspectives I'm curious to hear your perspective on. One, a couple months ago, I interviewed Callaway. You know him?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he used to have a newsletter where I think it was like weekly or monthly. He would do this thing. He would update with the numbers. And he said part of why he stopped is he started making enough money to where he wasn't really an underdog anymore. And he's like, I don't know if people want to know, like, now that I'm making as much money as I'm making, like, are people really going to care, or will they be more resentful? Right. I don't know if he used the word resentful. That's my words, but he used the word underdog. He wasn't an underdog anymore. So that's one perspective. And then another one, Tyler Denk, Beehive CEO, Chris Bell, owned by Beehive, full disclosure. He, I think like yesterday as we record, made a LinkedIn post, or maybe it was in his own newsletter, Big Desk Energy, about the monthly investor update that he sends every month. And he's been sending for like 40 months or however long it is. And there's around 400 people on the list. Current investors, people who have passed on investing, employees, et cetera. And the line I like from that is, for him, it's like, this is a forcing function for me to think about the business and organize my thoughts and like track these metrics that are important and understand which metrics are important to me and the business. And so these two perspectives is like, one, it's like Callaway, I'm sure he's still assembling these numbers for himself, but not sharing them anymore because he doesn't feel it serves his narrative. And then Tyler with this is like, only ever sharing some of these to the broader public, but always sharing them to like a select group of insiders for him to be accountable to.
Yeah, I can see both perspectives. I don't think I would like fully stop. I'd be open to like doing it again potentially. I was doing my like profit loss statements. I don't know if I want to go that deep though.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was doing in the past. Because people were like asking questions about it, and I was like trying to poke holes in it. And at the end of the day, I was writing it on a whiteboard. I was like, guys, come on.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not submitting this to the IRS here. Like,
I saw this, but I like the writing on the whiteboard is like a good, like, video. It's a great visual.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that too. And you know, you only have so much room on a whiteboard, so you would have, and obviously your profit and loss statement is massive. And so I would try to categorize it into like really broad categories. And then people would like, wait a second, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, guys, come on. Like, I'm trying to do my best here. Like, the board is only this big.
Yeah, I can only give you so much.
I can only give so much.
Let's talk about LinkedIn. So it's obviously become a much more competitive, thriving creator platform since you started posting on there. You said that you had that viral post back in 2019, a million views. That did really well. Beyond just the fact that more people are posting more on LinkedIn today, what's different about LinkedIn as a creator platform today since... compared to when you started?
Well, I mean, the elephant in the room is the video feed. I think LinkedIn is finally, like, after all these years, like, really leaning into the creator side of their platform. The challenge with LinkedIn is they have so many areas of business that actually create revenue for the product. And today, the creator side doesn't really make direct revenue. I'm sure, like, having creators on the platform is, like, indirect revenue, of course. More content on the platform, I mean, better for advertisers, et cetera, et cetera. But like, you know, they have a whole recruiting side of the business. They have the sales navigator. They have LinkedIn ads. They have marketing. It's like, so I don't think LinkedIn in the past like 5 years was really like investing too much into their creator economy. And I don't think it wasn't until maybe, honestly, maybe 2 years ago that they really started to like make an effort to say, okay, we need to pay attention. There's creators on the platform. Like, how can we better support them? And I've noticed now they have like community managers. If you're like a certain size of creator, I don't know their threshold, but they assign you a community manager. And so you have a direct line to someone from LinkedIn where you can ask them questions. They can fill you in on some trends that are coming up or new features that are coming up. And they've honestly done a really great job, in my opinion. I know other folks might disagree, but I personally think they've done a really great job of including the creators that are most active on their platform. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been invited to LinkedIn lunches, LinkedIn dinners, product launches, like basically being the first to know what's happening on the LinkedIn platform. That way, like, I can better show up on the platform, but then also like educate my audience on how they can better show up on the platform.
Mm-hmm. Educate us. Do you have an overarching strategy for your LinkedIn content that you could articulate for us?
Yeah, I can share my strategy as well, but I think LinkedIn, I want to share also what LinkedIn recommends, because I think it's actually one of my favorite pieces of recommendation that I always try to share with folks. The creators are typically not on LinkedIn. When someone says they're a content creator, the chances are they're probably not on LinkedIn. They're probably somewhere else. And what the mistake they make is that they think that they can just share whatever they're posting on their other channels onto LinkedIn. Like perfect example, I met someone from Nick Diagiovanni's team. They're like, he's like a huge YouTuber who like makes cooking content. I met someone from his team at a dinner, and they were saying that he is trying to be on LinkedIn. And I checked out his LinkedIn, and he's basically like posting like some of his cooking videos on LinkedIn. That's likely not going to work. People are not going to LinkedIn for cooking content, unfortunately.
You go to your Instagram Reels for that. Yeah.
You go elsewhere. And so LinkedIn recommends three things. They recommend news and trends. So if you are an expert in something in a certain industry, like let's just say you obviously run a successful like newsletter and media company, like if there's news going on in the podcasting world, well, you can actually speak on that and share your POV. You can give some commentary on news and trends, right? So that's one focus that you should maybe do on your LinkedIn, for example, right? The other is workplace stories. So this is like, you know, what did you learn while at AIR that can be a learning lesson for everyone else? Did you guys have a really successful campaign? Did you have a really bad campaign that maybe you learned a lot from? Or maybe your team was small and you were like really scrappy. Like these are things that are really interesting to share with other folks that are in similar scenarios. And then the third thing is career advice. So what did you learn during your career so far that someone can learn from you maybe 2-3 years behind you, right? And then even the opposite perspective, a lot of young people that I talk to are really hesitant to post on LinkedIn because they don't feel like they have enough to share. When in reality, there's folks that are more veterans in the space that are looking to young people to see like how they're talking, how they're thinking about things. And so you definitely have a lot to share no matter what stage of your career you're in.
Well, actually, that's a good question. So people who, you know, maybe they have a LinkedIn account, but they've never posted in earnest and they want to, you're saying that you don't necessarily need like the years of industry expertise to share there. It's more like perspective and opinion can be more or equally important to experience.
Yeah. And you likely have experience, right? Like something to share. Like people often think that they don't have as much experience or like enough to share. But think about like, even if you just got hired out of college, you just got your first job. Let's say you didn't even start day one of work yet. You still have enough to share because you landed a job, and someone that's a senior in college could learn from you because they want to actually land a job, right? So there's like always someone to step behind you that can learn something from your journey right now. So that's why I always recommend like just like share what you're continuously going through at each stage.
So you were talking about, you met the Nick Giovanni's guy on his team, and they were talking, you looked at his LinkedIn and it was just stuff that was clearly native for other platforms. In your own creation, are you like creating for LinkedIn first and then bringing some of that content to other platforms?
At this stage, I'm like mostly creating content that I know will perform better on LinkedIn, and it doesn't necessarily reflect great on other platforms. Like I made a conscious decision since starting the business that I want to invest all my time and energy into LinkedIn. Now I still am creating on other platforms, but like it's definitely secondary to LinkedIn. And what do I mean by that is, you know, a lot of my followers are people from my sales life. It's other founders. It's people within B2B marketing. And it's B2B marketing is a very niche topic. And so I'm trying to make content that addresses that particular audience. And when I post that on TikTok, for example, like those videos typically don't perform well, as you can imagine.
You still have like 40K followers on there almost.
Yeah, I got a lot of those followers from my sales days because I used to work in New York City in an office when I was employed at my sales job. And so I used to do a lot of like literally like day in my life in sales. And I used to like post in New York City and in my office. And I think that's where I grew a lot of my followers from TikTok. And once I made that switch to when I quit sales and started my own business, I saw a dramatic drop off in engagement from my TikTok, like huge, 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 huge drop off. But my LinkedIn literally doubled. So there was just like a dramatic shift. And I realized like, okay, there was just basically young people following me because they thought I had a cool job. And like, these are not people that are going to support my business in terms of like a client. And maybe there'll be a few of those for sure. But like majority of the followers that I saw in the comments and in my DMs were typically young people asking, how do you get a tech sales job? Whereas my LinkedIn engagement, it was like, you know, VP of marketing comments on a post or head of marketing or head of brand. And it's like, okay, that's where I want to spend more time and develop because I have this business. If I'm making content, I want to make it addressing to this audience.
Yeah. Is there any LinkedIn content, LinkedIn posting advice you see out there that you would say is just nonsense or just ignore it?
posting every day is pretty nonsense. You don't need to post every day. I did do that at one point. I will say, like, I would have my morning coffee and I would write a LinkedIn post every morning. I don't do that anymore. And you don't need to do that. And in fact, I actually think that's hurting folks rather than helping. I think when you're getting started, maybe it's helpful just to like build up that muscle and like, you know, remove that barrier of fear that you might have of posting on LinkedIn. And so, yeah, maybe that's a good exercise. One, it's not sustainable. Two, it's just not needed. Like no one actually, I mean, truthfully, nobody really wants to hear from you every single day. And if you're speaking every single day, multiple times per day, your posts are going to get less views. You're going to be like, you're oversaturating the feed. My opinion is if you can come and show up on LinkedIn one, two times a week, but in an extremely high value way with intention and value, people will be like really wanting more from you. And every time you post and they see your face pop up on their feed, they will stop and wait to hear what you have to say.
How about storytelling on LinkedIn? I know you do a lot of video first content. Is there anything about storytelling on LinkedIn where you want to make sure the structure is this specific way or the hooks are this specific kind of hook versus on other platforms, on an Instagram or a TikTok or a Twitter, any other platform? Is there something specific about storytelling that does really well on LinkedIn about the structure of the story?
Honestly, no. Like, I think like the storytelling element is, it reflects across any piece of content that you do on any channel. However, I will say LinkedIn has the opposite problem where there's not enough storytellers on the platform. So any amount of storytelling, it's like, I think maybe the question might be wrong. It's like, I don't think enough people are storytelling even, like, to answer your question. Like people are posting really bad stuff on LinkedIn, not like just like low quality. So the the bar is much lower. And so like usually the conversation I'm having with people on LinkedIn is like, no, you should think about storytelling. You shouldn't just say, I went to work, I filled up my coffee, I went to the mall. Like you need to be intentional about the story that you're telling. Like today I'm posting a video. I just spoke at a conference in New York on Saturday. And normally someone would film that, especially, I'm talking specifically on LinkedIn. On LinkedIn, most folks are just like, the first shot in the video is like, the sign or like them at the airport. It's like very chronological. It's like they're at the airport. They're like walking through the airport. They show up at the conference and it's like, it's just showing what they did. But for this example, I actually was late to my speaking session. I had to run up on stage when it had already started, which is pretty embarrassing. It wasn't my fault. But so that was the story that I then framed the entire video about, which I'll post.
What's the hook? Can you recite like the first line for us?
I almost completely missed my speaking slot. And I had to run through the hall or something like that.
That's good.
So that's like the what I'm framing it as. So now you're like, oh my God, like what, how, why did he miss that? And the video that I got of myself is me running, which is like real actual footage of me like running to the stage. And so that's where I frame the story around. Once you frame the story and like the hook, then you can go into the settings. Then immediately after the hook, I said, for context, I was speaking at this conference. It was a one-day summit in New York City, blah, 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 blah. And then you can start setting the stage. So I think like not enough folks are thinking about storytelling on LinkedIn specifically. And I think like when you do offer storytelling in your content on LinkedIn, it like really stands out. And oh, it's a super easy win.
One of my goals this year is to hit 10,000 followers on LinkedIn. It is honestly one of the most underrated social platforms. Helps me land podcast interviews, connect with smart people in the creator economy, and reach an audience that engages with what I'm doing. I'm currently at 4,967 followers. So the only way I'm going to get to 10,000 is by showing up consistently with useful content. To help with that, I have been using Taplio. Taplio is an all-in-one LinkedIn growth tool that helps creators like us build a real posting routine. I can generate first drafts from ideas, create image carousels without needing design tools, find relevant posts to engage with, and actually understand what my analytics are telling me. And as today's sponsor, Taplio is offering listeners a 7-day free trial plus your first month for just $1. Just head to taplio.com, that's taplio.com, and use code CREATOR1X1 to grab the offer and start building your own LinkedIn growth routine with Taplio today. I have seen you say that B2B influencer marketing is currently in V2, that the first wave, V1, was analysts speaking at events and getting paid for webinars or white papers, and the new wave is content creators in professional niches. What about a V3? What comes next?
V3 is on the way. V3 is on the way. You know, V1, it was like, you know, very old school. Like you hire Neil Patel to come speak at your mm-hmm. event. He's an influencer in some regard, right? I don't think he's, probably people are not going to Neil Patel today, but like that was yeah. V1. V2 was like, can we just pay this person to post about us? Like, it was like my first brand deal. It's like, this guy's in sales. We sell a sales product. Let's give him $200.
People like his posts. Yeah.
Yeah. They like it. He tagged us. Yeah. That's good. And then V3 is like more about like an integration of these creators. I'm seeing a lot of brands now incorporating creators in their events that they're going to, co-hosting events together. And also kind of working a little bit more. I'm surprised to see, but like I'm noticing brands working more with creators that are outside of the niche, which is kind of opposite of V2, right? It's like, take Air, for example. Like they're working with so many creators that are outside of the niche. But I think you need to pair it. You can't just have like, you can't just work with a creator that's like a really well-known creator outside of your niche and nothing else, because that just like doesn't help your cause. But you can't also, I don't think, just work specifically with folks in your niche. I think you need to have like kind of a mixture of both to be like culturally relevant. Like take like what Ramp did at their Super Bowl stunt. Like that was like textbook, in my opinion. It was like they have an A-list celebrity. That's technically an influencer, right? You have this like A-list celebrity. It's kind of relevant because he played like a role that you guys sell to. He played an accountant. They sell to accountants. Yeah. They have this big stunt. They match it with a commercial. They match it with digital content. They start working with creators that are really just more generic comedy creators to like help amplify the content. And then if you look at their other content, they're working with like specific folks in the finance space. So they have like this universe of creators that they're just like kind of hitting on all angles. And they're also blending those two together in some cases. Like there's videos with like a finance creator and a comedy creator like coming into one. Like they did one with a corporate humor creator, Varun Rana, who makes like really niche, like funny tech content. And then they like paired it with this, I can't think of the page name, but it's like that coffee shop in Brooklyn where it's like a comedy page.
Blank Street? Oh, no.
No, not Blank Street. I forget what it's called. They have like a page where they like create these like really hipster Brooklyn characters, and they have different characters come into the coffee shop, and it's all scripted.
I've seen this. Yeah. I wish I could. We'll find it. Tom will put it in here in the video.
Yeah.
Did you work with Ramp? Because I saw on social that you were at the Super Bowl at the Ramp engagement. Were you one of Ramp's influencers here?
We just sent like 4 creators out there. Okay. So we did not come up with any like creative for that in terms of like they pretty much had the stunt set up. They had everything. They had this tailgate though, and we basically just sent like 4 creators on their behalf, of course, like to help amplify it. So we were just a very, very tiny part of it. But we sent, going back to what I was saying earlier, mixing different types of creators.
Yeah.
There's a creator called he has a show called The Career Ladder, where he stands on an actual ladder.
I've seen
this. And he gets someone else on the other side, and he tries to guess their career. And so we set that up to have him come to the tailgate with his ladder. It was Max, the guy from Career Ladder, the host, and then Brian Baumgartner, which was the celebrity they use. Yeah. Exactly. And so he had to guess his new job, which is like spokesperson of Ramp. And that was really great. That video got like 6 million views, I think.
Wow.
And then we sent some like corporate humor creators out there to do some skits. And then the other thing that we sent out there was, I think if you're doing any type of event and you're thinking about influencer marketing, try to find, like, you're going to need services, like vendors. You're going to need food vendors, photographers, videographers, band, music, whatever. Try to find creators that also provide those services. That way you get the extra distribution, and it's a familiar face. So like people are excited that, like in Ramp's example, we had an SF local creator named Brandon. He has a company called Poor Boy. It's a coffee business. Mm-hmm. So we hired him. He supplied a service. He literally provided coffee with lattes with Brian's face on it. But then he also created content and like recapped the event.
It's so V3 is like content everywhere across categories. Everybody is creating at every single possible touch point to overblow it a little bit. But question about V2 versus V3, is there something different about how success is measured in V2 versus V3?
Yeah. You know, I think early on with the brands that even I was a part of as a creator, like in the early days of like LinkedIn stuff, is they really just wanted you to tag them. Like that was their big thing. It's like, we just want people talking
about it. That was the success metric. Like maybe successful. Like followers on this account plus tags plus views.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think, I mean, this is like super generally speaking, each campaign has different objectives, right? Sometimes there's signups, sometimes there's just awareness, whatever the case is. I think one of the interesting things that we've been doing with clients right now, especially in the B2B space, when B2B buying cycles are 6 to 8 months long and you can't just put your credit card in and buy 6-7 figures worth of Salesforce software. I'm using that as the example. One of the reportings that we're actually doing is showing like which accounts are actually engaging with our influencers content, which is a relevant data point to see like, okay, is our content getting in front of the right audience? And is this account now aware of us by seeing this content? And they might not take action right now. They might not see our influencers post and go to our website and book a demo with us. That's usually not how the buyer's journey goes. But that touch point is part of their overall buyer's journey where 6-7, you know, 3 months later, they might actually take an action like downloading, attending a webinar, or even reaching out to the sales team.
How are you tracking that? Like that this content got in front of this desired account?
So all that data is public on the LinkedIn post. So if you look at, you know, someone's LinkedIn post, you can see like the person from the company that they're commenting on. And so we just like, we'll create a report of all the companies that have engaged with our influencers content.
That makes sense. Last thing, where would you like Creator Buzz to be, let's say a year and a half from now? So, you know, about twice its lifetime, where would you like it to be?
You know, what's crazy. I actually don't have any like specific revenue goals for Creator Buzz. I don't think its future would ever be like this like big VC business, nor do I want it to be that.
Yeah.
I want to get it to a point in a year and a half, I want to get it to a point where one, the team is larger, the operations and like the systems are in place where like things can run much smoother, because right now we're kind of still in like early stage growth, like stuff is manual, stuff's all over the place. Like I don't have an ops background, I'm not organized. Where like we get new clients and like things are automated in terms of like onboarding, you know, influencer comms, like all this stuff is just like humming. And then I can kind of remove myself a little bit from like the more like day-to-day decisions that need to be made. That way I can focus more on the strategic like growth of the business. And so that's our main goal, to be honest with you.
What about like what you're able to offer? Like with this ramp example, you said you're a tiny part of this activation. Is that a goal for you to be like a larger part of an activation like that?
Yeah, I think I would love. I mean, we started pitching brands with some like creative help as well. So like, hey, we're just in a new business call. Obviously, I won't say the name of the company until we close it. But we were in a new business call yesterday. They're doing this user conference in the summertime. And we actually started to pitch them some like more creative things about like experiences that we can do. We, to be honest, haven't done a lot of that, but that's something that I get excited about. And I think pairing that with influencers is like the ultimate ROI, because they're going to help with the distribution. And so that's definitely an area that we would like to play more in.
Yeah, makes sense. I guess, is it creatorbuzz.com?
Creatorbuzz.com.
If people want to work with you, whether as brands or creators, they can go to creatorbuzz.com. Is there anything else you would like to leave us with?
No, that's it. Feel free to give me a follow on LinkedIn if you are trying to up your LinkedIn game. Happy to chat, give some advice, and also maybe you can check out some examples of some stuff I'm doing.
There we go. Thank you for coming on, Vin. And listener, we will see you next week.
Hi there. My name's Tom. I'm the producer of the Creator Spotlight podcast. If you enjoyed that episode, I would recommend this episode with Jade Powell next. She's a creator and social media strategist that has worked with massive brands like Apple TV, Delta Airlines, and a bunch more. And as a creator, just like Vin, she uses LinkedIn as her main platform. So I'd recommend that one next. It's one of our most popular episodes. Go click on that one.